Who am I? All right, no. I'm actually going to give this talk, which is structure versus style. Can we dim the lights a tiny bit? Because I have a lot of black slides. Lights? Anyone? Bueller? Yes. Okay. So how many people have seen a talk by me before, like last year's talk or whatever? Okay, so I try, I'm on the advisory board for the conference, and things, I kind of know the things we look for in talks, and I try and give talks that kind of fit that. They have a number of characteristics. For example, they're concrete. They're about, you know, something specific that you can take away from the talk. You know, problem being solved or whatever. They hopefully have fancy demos. That's always cool, right? Eye candy, gotta love that. Perhaps attached to a big name game like last year's. That's cool. Like everybody likes to, you know, have something that can hold on to you. The ultimate thing is provide a solution. If you, for example, had the same problem that we had last year with Spore, like you have a 10-legged creature with four mouths and you want to animate him, hopefully after watching last year's talk, you'd have some idea of how we solved it, and you could decide to do it that way or at least or change or whatever. Today's talk has absolutely none of those characteristics. So you've been warned. Okay, I'm going to start with a question. Everyone close their eyes. Everyone? Like you? Okay. What technology has had the most profound impact on games? And you can take like the CPU and the graphics card and the display and stuff for granted. But like of the software technologies, the code we write, that kind of thing, you know, has it been HDR rendering? Has it been rigid body dynamics? You know, whatever. You know, think about what you think the most profound technology that has the most profound impact on games. And again, I'm not saying this is the one that should have had the most profound impact on games, but what did have. Okay, you can open your eyes now. Here's my answer. I claim it's the texture map triangle has had the most profound impact on games of any technology so far. Let's talk about the texture map triangle for a moment. If you have a triangle and you have a texture, a bitmap, when you put those two things together and render them in 3D, you get something that is massively more than the sum of its parts. You basically get 3D virtual reality, right? Like you get, sprites alone or flat shaded polygons alone don't do it. Together, they create this like gritty granularity, this kind of toothiness to the world. That is really compelling. I mean, you get a visceral, emotional reaction to it. Why is that? Why are triangles so effective? Not perceptually or anything like that. But what about them? What about this decomposition of a problem, which is how do we make 3D virtual reality? What makes triangles, texture map triangles, such a successful solution to that problem? And I claim it's that you can break it down into two pieces. It decomposes into an incredibly powerful structure. In this case, X, Y, Z, U, W at the vertices, width, height, and depth of the texture map, the texels actually in the texture map, like the red pixel and then a blue pixel and whatever, the connectivity information of the mesh. That's the structure of this solution to this problem. And the computer can reason about that at an incredibly deep level. There's all kinds of things you can do, both with the morphology, meaning like you can transform it and render it on the screen. You can light it. You can hit test it, collision detect. Topologically speaking, you can walk along the topology. You can knit other triangles into it. There's all kinds of reasoning you can do, both as the programmer and as the computer, once you teach the computer how to do it, given this well-defined well-chosen structure. But also, as the flip side, not in contrast, but in concert with it, it has this amazingly expressive style. The artists can represent things, just massive diversity of things, with the degrees of freedom exposed by the texture map triangle. In this case, has minimal degrees of freedom for the problem. Like a triangle is, the minimal is a 2D simplex. So for representing a surface in 2D, it's like the minimal, mathematically minimal thing you want to do for linearity. Blah blah blah. But they're simple. They're easy to understand. They're linear. You can like work with them. You can add them together. You can subtract them. You can move them around. But they're also really intuitive, both geometrically speaking, the geometry degrees of freedom here, meaning changing what the triangle shape is, and the texture pixels are just an awesome intuitive degree of freedom. This is my personal favorite Quake skin. So those two things together are just incredibly powerful. This is I want to be clear. Like, this is way deeper than data driving a piece of code. Like, this is not like I got my little text file that's got my parameters in it for my algorithm and like I can hot load that. That's cool. I love data driving. But this is like deep at the like heart of the problem is this. You don't say like the texture map is data driving the polygon. Like, it's not, you just don't talk about it in those terms. It's just inherent in the solution. It brings a tear to my eye. They're like living in perfect harmony. So there are a lot of other examples of this kind of structure versus style decomposition. Basically, everywhere you look, where really excellent solutions that just really kick the butt of the problem they're trying to solve exist. Skin, mesh, and bones, like, you know, just linear skin, bone weighting and that kind of thing, has a very clear structure style decomposition. The bones have the connectivity, the skin's weighted to them. You know, you can do IK on the bones. I can put my foot down on a stair. I can reach. I can do look at. The mesh goes along, whether it's an orc mesh or a little schoolgirl or whatever. Like, you've got this awesome degrees of freedom. The computer can reason about where the guy is by just looking at the bones with maybe some bounding information. It's an excellent degree of freedom for both the computer to work with and the artist to express something in. Wavetable synthesis, perhaps like kind of the granddaddy of these kind of decompositions. I mean, this is just awesome. Like, the bits inside the individual samples can represent anything from, you know, like a screech to like a beautiful guitar solo. The you know, where you choose to play them, blend operators you can do between them. And obviously, like, you can download, you know, you can go buy something like the Vienna Symphonic Library, and basically, hey, in your, you know, on your $1,000 PC, you've got an entire symphony now using this kind of using this technique. This decomposition has enabled that to happen at that level of expressivity and power. Some more slightly abstract examples. A lot of some SIGGRAPH research in the past 5 years dealing with like motion capture processing. You get these big databases of motion capture data. This is a bitmap or a screenshot from the Style Machines paper by Brandon Hertzman, 2000. What these guys did is they write programs that they look at this giant motion library and then try and figure out the structure that's inherent within that data. Like, you know, motion capture data is basically a big pile of data, right? And you got to clean it up and everything. So what these guys do is, by example, they try and derive the structure out of that, and then they can reason about the structure in code while the style still is layered on top. So, for example, one of the crazy results they have in their paper is you can have an amateur ballet dancer dance ballet A, and then a professional ballet dancer dance ballet A. And then they can difference in some space those two ballets, and then they can have an amateur ballet dancer dance ballet B and apply the difference in professionalism space and get something resembling a professional ballet dancer dancing ballet B. This is pretty cool, and there's a lot of hand waving going on, and like, you know, there's you know, but I mean, that's a pretty awesome like goal, and they've gotten some of the way there. A kind of different way of approaching this problem is work by Lucas Kovar on his motion graph stuff, where there's a big giant motion database, and you want to be able to generate motions that weren't explicitly captured. So he's got a dude, he wants to walk it along this cursive writing. All he had was a database of guys walking, and he can go and figure out where they're turning and which places to switch between the motion by figuring out what structure there is in the motion data. Yet you could have, like, you know, dude hobbling along this or guy skipping along this, and that's the style layered on top, and the structure is separate from that. Okay. A lot of the problems we solved on Spore actually have this decomposition. The stuff I talked about last year with the creature animation, we actually, one might use the word force the animators to tell us what the structure is up front. They say, you know, they fill in this, like I talked about last year, they fill in this like Mad Lib basically. Like, hey, I'm going to do an animation between this grasper and the external target, and the mouth is going to be like this high off the ground, you know, relative to the height of the creature and that kind of thing. And then we use that structural information that they've given us, that we make them specify in the UI, and we record the stylistic information in the frame that creates. And obviously, like, this is on the web and everything, so you can talk, you can go listen to that talk if that interests you. But there's a very clear structure versus style decomposition there. Spore Creature Paint works the same way. This is a joint work with Henry Goffin. You've got these scripts that can reason about the game exposes to the paint scripts the structure of the creature. Like, you can reason about it, saying, hey, I want to go along the limb or across the limb. I want to be at the top of the head or whatever. And then you've got these these brushes, these deep, rich brushes, and the like decision about how you want to use that structural information, and you get pretty cool results. Better results than you would just get by randomly kind of, you know, reaction diffusioning textures under these guys. Here's a really obvious example that we all kind of deal with every day. Here's my homepage, which I endeavor greatly to make look like something I edited in Emacs in 1995. But it actually, like, it runs on MediaWiki and it's got, like, all this high-powered, like, Web 2.0 crap underneath it, which allows me to easily switch out the CSS. And here's the exact same structure, obviously, and here's my web page in, like, Wiki 1.0 kind of, like, I think they call this one nostalgia is the theme. But you get the idea, the structure versus style decomposition, there's a structure, you know, it's the markup versus the stylistic stuff. It's been a big movement in the web, and people are talking about one of the cool things about the web nowadays is that the data is structured enough that you can have computers reason about it. That's where Google starts to come in and, like, all of these, like, kind of semantic markup things. Typefaces are another really good example where you've got this very defined structure. I've got the alphabet, perhaps the Unicode alphabet, whatever. I've got the concept of, like, ligature and kerning and things like that, and I've got to just ton of data that allows you just mass quantities of stylistic expression within a typeface. I mean, just go to any of these freefonts.com kind of places, and it's just like, woo! Okay, so I claim that, I find this structure versus style decomposition everywhere what I call hard interactive problems are being solved. So what do I mean by hard interactive problems? Let's talk about what I don't mean first. I do not mean wicked problems. This sounds silly, but it's actually a kind of problem. I was introduced by Clint Hawking in a lecture he gave here a few years ago. But you can go on Wikipedia and read about, like, what the characteristics of a wicked problem are. But, like, a canonical example of a wicked problem is, like, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Like, that is a really fucking hard problem. Like, that, you know, characteristics of wicked problems are, like, you don't know that you've solved it until you actually solve it, and, like, it's totally, like, the change. It's changing all the time. Like, all the people are players, and okay. Clint was kind of making the argument that game design in the large is a wicked problem, meaning how do I make this AAA game fun for $10 million or whatever. I don't know whether that's a wicked problem or not, but it's certainly harder than the kind of problems I'm talking about. It's more open-ended. If we're not talking about how do I make a game fun? Like, I'm not suggesting that there's some algorithm for doing that or some decomposition that will help you do that. I don't know. And neither does anybody else, which is the great thing about our industry. I'm not talking about easy problems. And my definition of an easy problem might be slightly annoying to people who go in and program every day, including myself, I will at least sympathize, because my definition of easy problem is anything with a quantitative success metric. So you might define, like, how do I render 500 million triangles a second on, you know, a 386? That's an impossible problem, but it's also easy in the sense that you can easily print out a scalar number that says whether you succeeded or failed, right? It's got this quantitative success metric. Whereas I claim these hard interactive problems do not. You can extend this, like, having a quantitative success metric actually extends to, I don't care about RAM, CPU, even P versus NP. You might have an NP complete problem, but if you can generate a scalar that says how good you're doing on that, then I claim it's an, quote, easy problem. Now, this is the majority of what we spend our time on when we're, like, sweating it at the keyboard, right? So they're not easy in any, like, reasonable human definition, but compared to the problems I'm talking about, they're easy. They don't require these leaps, and they don't require one important thing that I'm about to talk about. The problems that I'm talking about are problems that happen at the intersection of technology, obviously, because we're games on computers, right? Aesthetics, both gameplay aesthetics and visual aesthetics and audio aesthetics and that sort of thing, basically anything there's very subjective artistic judgment about, and interactivity. And interactivity is the key that separates us from a bunch of people that we're kind of highly related to in a lot of other ways, like in a day-to-day basis, like, for example, film. People talk about, you know, like, you know, we go to Cigarette, they come here, yada, yada. But, like, in something like The Perfect Storm, you know, we've got this water simulator, and some really smart people worked on this water simulator, but at the end of the day, if it comes down to it, they could have painted every frame in Photoshop, right? Because it doesn't have to be interactive. They didn't. I mean, I think they probably touched up a lot of stuff in post. I don't know the full story. But, they don't have to deal with this guy, right? Bonus points if anyone knows who this is. It is. It's Dave Taylor. It also happened to be the best gamer picture I could find on the internet. So, So this feedback loop between the player and the game algorithms like makes us have to deal with problems at a deeper level than linear media, non-interactive media. Okay. So here's my theory. First, I must introduce to you this icon, which is that I'm probably smoking something here. It's really hard to find a really nice picture of a crack pipe on Google Images, so Magritte's pipe will have to do. From here on out, this lecture gets pretty abstract. My theory is that solutions to hard interactive problems will always have a structure versus style decomposition and a good one. Like, good solutions will have a good structure versus style decomposition. Okay? Why do I think this? I think this because of two things. Interactivity, by its very nature of being on a computer, demands that the computer be in the loop of whatever the solution is, right? Like, it's going to have to be part and parcel of solving this problem with us. But emotion and aesthetics, like these things that make our game something more than just like some batch, you know, some like random program you download, require that a human be in the loop. We don't know how to have computers do this yet. And I'll talk a little bit about that later, but like that thing that makes, you know, that flowered wallpaper different from that rusty thing is something a computer can't do that yet. We don't know what that means, but a human can do that instantly. So I want to take a little bit of a segue and talk about different ways that humans can be in the loop. So there's two things in the world of programs, right? There's algorithms and data. And humans can participate in both of these, obviously. The most obvious thing is humans can type in the algorithms, right? Duh. Humans can also execute the algorithms. Anybody know what this is? Yeah, this is the Mechanical Turk from, like, I don't think it's 1780-something. So this is a chess-playing robot built in the 1700s, obviously with a dude in the box. It was the sensation of all the salons, right? We have a modern version of this, which is multiplayer games, right? Like, on the other end of your crosshairs is some guy, like, you know, hopefully getting you in his crosshairs, and they're both executing, you know, algorithms to play the game with each other. From the data standpoint, the obvious one there is generation. Like, you know, you go into Photoshop and you paint a texture. But there's also a couple other slightly less intuitive ones. Like, there's illustrative or example-based methods. Like, in Spore, the thing that actually animates the creature at the end is not actually something being, it's not what the animator did. It's like interpretation of what the animator did in a different creature they'd never seen before. Like, it's the animator's trying to help the system, teach the system how to do this, not just play back the information. And another one that's getting really popular with in the web these days is this kind of judgment aspect of manipulating data. In Spore, as I think Carol Shaw talked about this morning, we're doing a lot of collaborative filtering, kind of Amazon style, like, you know, voting this guy better than that, feeds, that kind of thing. Another a really interesting place where this pops up is in the Me channel. If you want to make a Me on the Wii, you have two choices here. You can start from scratch, right? Or you can choose a lookalike. And if you choose a lookalike, so starting from scratch is the obvious thing. You get like a blank guy and you like dial in his mouth and whatever. So choosing a lookalike gives you this grid of randomly generated guys. And then you pick one you like, and then it starts generating, it makes a Dawson inspired blind watchmaker interface to let you choose and kind of guide the simulation of the randomization of this thing, and you eventually get where you want to go, hopefully. We often think of humans and computers like in conflict like this, but obviously when solving these problems, it needs to be a lot more like this, like in concert, right? I never saw this movie, but I think that's a hilarious picture. And so it behooves us to kind of understand what computers do well and what humans do well, and like there's we all kind of have an intuitive idea of what that is, right? Like, humans are really good at pattern matching and interpretive, you know, analogical interpretive leaps and that sort of thing. Computers are really good at, you know, grinding big chunks of numbers and that sort of thing. It's kind of interesting, and to take another slight segue, you can actually nowadays do less hand waving and quantify things that computers are good at versus humans. How much would you pay me to tell you what these letters and numbers say? I'm thinking about $0, right? Because everyone in this room can see trivially that it says A6KN, right? This is obviously a CAPTCHA, a way of telling computers and humans apart. So is there a value here? Yes, because it's very cheap for humans to do this, but it's very expensive for computers to do this. And you can actually compute how expensive it is for computers, because there's a guy in China who will sell you software to break these CAPTCHAs. So you can see these really easy ones go for about $500. And it kind of coming down. Here's like a $1,500 one. Coming down here. He starts to get a little, so here's Ticketmaster, $6,000, 50% success rate. So, like, you want to, like, apparently busting Ticketmaster's CAPTCHAs is big business these days, because you can, like, arbitrage the tickets and, like, scalp them. Here's Google. Currently doesn't have a price. He has a little editorial commentary on how good the CAPTCHA is. There's a rundown there. Yahoo's is down there, and he's like, I think this is breakable. Like, I didn't screenshot that. But so you can kind of quantify like the heat difference between what it takes a computer to solve versus what it takes a human to solve. It's interesting because humans, the whole point of a CAPTCHA is computers can generate them really quickly. It's just they can't solve them. There are things that humans can generate that humans can't solve either. Like, I can easily, like, rattle off some giant number, but I can't tell you whether it's prime or not, right? And computers are a little not that great at that either, but they're better than we are. I can generate a matrix, and a computer can invert it instantly, or tell me whether it's not invertible. But I can't do that. Here's kind of the inverse, which is the Amazon Mechanical Turk. This is a way of... So Amazon's doing all these, like, web service things nowadays. Like, you know, they have the Elastic Compute Cloud and all these kinds of things that, like, startups can use to, like, get server space or, you know, computational resources without having to have, like, a Google-sized farm. Here's, like, kind of a wacky one. They have a place where they have a marketplace for doing stuff that computers suck at that humans are good at. So, for example, the first thing on the list here is looking for drainage in a GIS database of pictures. And they will pay you 3 cents to say yes or no about whether or not a picture has drainage in it. And so, hey, you click through, like, you know, God, I mean, what, thousands of those an hour and go totally mind-numbingly insane for 3 cents a click. But computers can't do that for any cents a click, so with any kind of predictability. So it's kind of interesting. Like, it's not clear what relevance this has to the lecture or games, but I think it's pretty cool, and it's clearly, like, tangentially related. There's something happening here. It's kind of interesting. All right. So people are constantly trying to bridge the gap, right? So, like, there's going this way, which is like the Rain Man wave, which is make humans more like computers. And that's kind of interesting in a kind of, like, you know, wacky sociological standpoint, but we're not shipping a human in every box, so it's not really an option for us. Going the other way, which is making computers creative, a bunch of people, most famously Douglas Hofstadter, have looked at this and, like, this is a really great book, and he's got a lot of crazy cool ideas here, but this stuff is basically a failure so far. Like, they have not succeeded in intelligence, they have not succeeded in making computers act in a meaningful way creative, even on really small things like generating fonts. Like, it doesn't work very well, and people have tried really hard. So for the time being, we're stuck. And we're stuck using humans for what they're good at and using computers for what they're good at. But hey, that means we're all employable still, so that's a good thing. Okay. So here's a question for the second half. So I said the texture map triangle was had the most profound impact on games so far. What should have had the most profound impact on games? Everybody got their answer? Here's my answer. I claim AI should have had the most profound impact on games so far, and has not. I think that AI technology is the key to the holy grail of all these things we're looking at in terms of interactivity, real consequence, and meaning from what the player does. And I think that we have not yet found a structure versus style decomposition for AI, and that's the reason it has not done so hot. It gets more and more controversial from here on out. Along this sense, and I apologize for the next slide because it's just so cheap, but, like, but once you start looking for fail on Google Images, like, you got a lot of cool stuff. Like, this is... Okay, so... I could go on, but I won't. Okay, so... In order to figure out why we haven't, or what it might look like when we do actually find a structure versus style decomposition, I'm ashamed of all of you for laughing at that. That's so cheap. That is just so beneath you. Okay. What is structure and what is style? Again, the warning symbol popping up here. Okay. Thought about this. This is really new thinking. I've given 3 lectures about this topic in the past 8 months to a year, or 8 months, and it's changed drastically each time because this is very like new thinking for me. So this is still, I mean, hopefully some of you will have a better idea than what I'm talking about, and you will talk about it on the web and at GDC. Here's where I've gotten so far on this. So remember, I was saying before that the structure is kind of the description of how you're talking about things, and the style is like what you're talking about. So to kind of try and be concrete, I claim the structure is the static specification of the degrees of freedom of describing the object. So in this case, you know, X, Y, Z, W for a vertex, or X, Y, Z, U, V, whatever. Excuse me. The fact that these are the ways you're going to talk about it is the structure of the problem. Okay? And then the style are what you fill into those slots, like what values you put in there. So what your X, Y, and Z are, like what the bits of your texture are, how you change those are what give you the specific objects that you're talking about. The structure is unchanging, and that staticness is incredibly important. Why? Because the staticness is what allows you, as the person making this, you know, working with these objects, to reason about them. And it is what allows you to teach the computer to reason about them, too. I'm not saying that, like, you can't have quads. You only have to have triangles. But if you're going to have quads or triangles, you have to have a degree of freedom that says which one it is. Or if you have n-gons, there's got to be an n, and that is a piece of your degrees of freedom. That is a description of your problem. I would claim that triangles are actually better than doing that for various reasons that I'll talk about in a second. But whatever. I mean, you can have a NURBS curve if you want, but that structure, it's not sometimes a NURBS curve and sometimes a triangle if you don't have a way of describing what that means to be both. So it's that staticness of that that allows you to write code that grinds over it and does interesting things like raycasting or collision detecting or rasterizing or whatever. On the other hand, the style, while it works within the constraints of what these are the degrees of freedom you've provided for to do something with, the style itself is malleable. You can write code that changes it. You can blend between it. I can go in and set the color of pixels. I can move vertices. I can transform them around. And in sense, in this one I was resisting for a long time, but I've now kind of come to terms with, it's data. Like, the style is data. It's not trying to be code. And I'm going to spend much of the rest talking about that, what that means. So choosing degrees of freedom for style is an art form. Like, I think I've come up with 5 characteristics they need to have. I'm not sure if these are the right 5, but they seem to sit right with me right now, here on stage with a PowerPoint slide already prepared with these 5 on them. They need to be intuitive. The pixels in a bitmap for a texture map are very intuitive. I can put red in them, and it shows up on the screen as red. Or even if it's like, you know, just it's the albedo versus the like normal map, I can like tweak those things, and they make some sense to me. The positions of the vertices, that sort of thing. They're also expressive. You can easily have intuitive things that don't actually express much of anything. The power in a texture map and a triangle is that it allows you to do all these varying different things that we've been showing. They're frugal, meaning they don't have degrees of freedom. I was originally going to put minimal here, but I don't think that's actually true. So, for example, if you think about quaternions versus Euler angles, Euler angles are more intuitive and more frugal, but they have these other problems, singularities, efficiency on the computer, and that sort of thing. But Euler angles are by definition minimal for describing a rotation in 3D. I mean, there's a bunch of different ways of describing rotations in 3D. All of them, it's provable mathematically, suck, and that's why we use quaternions. They're less intuitive and a little less frugal. You pay back in a couple other ways. They're more linear. They don't have singularities, that sort of thing. So frugality is important. It's a weighting factor, but you're not going for ultimate minimalness of degrees of freedom. This is kind of, if you're into physics, there's like a generalized coordinates versus augmented coordinates thing kind of going on here. This is a key thing. They are blendable. So what do I mean by when I say blendable? Well, for some of the degrees of freedom, blendability is just like, hey, I've got, you know, t times a plus 1 minus t times b, and I, like, lerp t, and, like, hey, I get some value c. That's easy blendable, right? Like, I have some, it's a plus and a multiply operator, and, like, it works. topology doesn't work that way. I mean, a bunch of people have tried in SIGGRAPH and like Eurographics to try and make topology work that way for a mesh, for example. They're not quite there. Some interesting ideas. But I claim that mesh topology, even with current technology, is blendable in the sense that I mean blendable. I can do Boolean ops. I can stitch triangles together. I can reason about it and work between two definitions. It's not just a directly like floating point scalar blendable kind of thing. It's this idea that I can have two of these things and then do something interesting with the pairing. And then finally, they have to be efficient. Like you can't like if it's a completely. And this is one of the Euler-Engel problems as well. These degrees of freedom that you expose to people have to be. operatable by the computer, obviously, because that interactivity is key, right? These change over time, based on like how fast computers are, what our understanding of technology is, you know, where people are, what the tool set is. But like, so for example, it took a long time for the triangle to win. On my bookshelf at home, in my home office, I have an NV1. Does anyone remember an NV1? It's NVIDIA's first graphics card. It did quadrilateral curved surfaces. Not very popular. It wasn't the right decomposition. It was interesting. Lots of people were trying lots of crazy stuff back then and before. Like, triangles didn't become preeminent for a long time. I think triangles won in part because of these characteristics, but they're always having to defend their first place, right? Like, constantly like, oh, it's going to be ray tracing. Oh, no, it's going to be, you know, like, implicit surfaces, whatever. And they're constantly, like, beating back the hordes of pretenders to the throne. Something might come along that's better than a triangle. That may be. I claim it will be better along the style and structure axis if it does, and that's the way you can judge whether it is. So, for example, in physics, the rigid body is kind of clawed its way to the top of the hill, constrained rigid bodies, but I don't think it's necessarily going to stay there forever because it doesn't feel like it actually hits all of these degrees of freedom very well. It doesn't provide... it doesn't provide the kind of stylistic degrees necessarily. Like, it doesn't. Obviously, it's not soft. It's not efficient for certain kinds of operations. I mean, it could be that something like constrained particles with a really good implicit integrator actually turns out to be better because it's more like flexible. I don't know. I mean, again, I'm not trying to answer that question. I'm trying to say that like you can kind of judge these like solutions to these hard interactive problems by like running it up against these characteristics and see how it fares. Okay. So, let's talk about structure versus style for AI. I have no solutions to this problem, so I'm going to talk about some popular forms of game AI and academic AI very super hand-wavily briefly, and then make some totally wild-ass prognostications. So let's start with four different, like, kind of cutting-edge-ish game AI types. There's Sims-style game AI, which... just the super brief version is, hey, there's objects in the world. The characters in the world have motives, you know, whether I have to go to the bathroom, whether I have to, you know, whether I'm hungry, that kind of thing. The objects advertise for how they manipulate those motives, right? So, like, hey, the bathroom lets you, like, decrease your I got to go to the bathroom motive, yada, 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 the hunger, whatever. They all vote, and then somebody decides to run, and then what runs is some code that then goes and modifies. It plays some animations, it sequences some stuff, it modifies some state in the world, and modifies your motives, and out you come, right? At its super bare-boned cartoon caricature level. The Halo and we use this on Spore behavior tree style stuff that Damien Isla wrote about in on Gamma Sutra and gave talks about is a very different way of working. It is basically a finite state machine on steroids. It's basically a force multiplier for like allowing your finite state machines to scale way beyond where they would if they were just a bunch of switch statements. Things come down. It's a way of prioritizing, kind of like the Sims voting thing in some sense. But priorities come. The state of the world is sent down, and the behavior tree decides which behaviors to activate and which ones to shut down. It's got a protocol for shutting them down, and the thing that makes it scalable, more scalable as a finite state machine. Each one of these internal things is just a little finite state machine, but it switches between them such that if I'm eating and like an enemy comes near, I don't need to have the flee from enemy switch state inside the eating code. So I avoid the n-squared problem, right? Which just allows it to scale. It's not pretending to be anything more than a really stoked finite state machine. It's just making that a lot more authorable. But at the end of the day, the things that are inside these things inside these leaves are code, little pieces of code, finite state machines that execute on the world. This is a screenshot from King of Chicago, which is an Amiga game like about a million years ago, and you might wonder why it's on here, but it's a cool screenshot because it's actually very similar to the technology used in Facade. So I always like to give props to Doug because he did it in 1982 or something like that. This is Doug Sharp. There's a state space. So in the case of King of Chicago, it was about the Chicago mob scene. In the case of Facade, it was about, you know, a divorce and you walked in on it, basically. There's a state vector, so like, you know, whether Lola the mall is mad at you, whether you're you know, whether you've done a good job running the gang lately or whatever, that's your state in this n-dimensional space. It finds story snippets that are nearby, which then those modify the state, which jump your vector around and it continue, etc. Again, the thing that runs in here is code, right? It's a little finite state machine that modifies your state vector. This is a screenshot from Jeff Orkin's Three States in a Plan GDC lecture about the Fear AI, which is kind of a strips planner kind of thing. The constraint system that says whether or not I have to open the door first and that kind of thing is dynamically figured out. It's a planner. But at the end of the day, you're writing code snippets that have preconditions and postconditions, and those get threaded together and executed, right? So these all are... They all use data in a different way, but they all have code underlying them for pretty obvious reasons, right? Here are two kind of more traditional academic AI approaches. Neural nets, which everybody knows and hates, really don't have much code associated with them internally. Like, it's not sequencing code. It's got a lot of data. That it tunes these weights. You've got the input layer, and it tunes all the hidden stuff, and then the output, and like, you know, different outputs come, and you've got to pick your degrees of freedom. So this actually kind of feels structural. It's got some degrees of freedom. The problem is the degrees of freedom are just completely opaque. You have no idea what's going on. You can retrain it, like, oh, it's not doing right. Maybe send it more pictures of white things, right? But you have no idea what's going on in there. It's like completely opaque, and which is one of the reasons they kind of fail every time people try and use them. But it's at least at this data level, which is kind of interesting. This is a fuzzy if-then rules. Similar in the sense that there's this, like, the thing that makes the decisions is based on this data, and in a fuzzy if-then rule, you can actually like kind of paint it. You can kind of say like, oh, this is Gaussian blobs about this big and whatever, and here's how much I tip the waiter, right? But they seem really weak. They're just very, I mean, you can write controllers for thermostats with them, but they don't seem like you can do much like behavioral stuff with them, game behavioral stuff. But it's kind of interesting because the degrees of freedom are there, and the stylistic degrees are data. Like, you can paint it, basically. But it's super weak. So... So what are the styles of degrees of freedom for AI? Well, I don't know. I would be typing it instead of talking to you people right now if I knew. But I can say I think what they're not going to be. Does behavior mean code? I used to think yes. I used to think you have to have code to execute behavior. And now let's be clear. There is code, and I'll talk about it in the next slide. There is code in all of these things, whether you're talking about texture map triangles or like, you know, whatever. But where does the code live? Can code be a style degree of freedom? Is it something that fits those criteria? One thing that pops into people's minds when you talk about code and style and making it accessible is this kind of thing, like flowcharts. This is a screenshot just randomly picked of the massive AI stuff from the Weta guys. This is a flowchart, right? You know, like, you say, hey, you collect your nodes together and blah, blah, blah. This is still code. Like, you can pretend this isn't code, but this is, right? The kind of personality that can understand, the kind of brain structure that can understand this is exactly the kind of thing that can understand where curly braces go. It's not, and I'm not claiming people who can program are better than people who can't program or anything. In fact, the whole point of this lecture is like, hey, let a thousand flowers, like, you know, I used to say let a thousand flowers bloom. Do you guys know where that came from? It's like Mao talking about killing a bunch of people in China. I need to stop saying it. I just finally, like, I was like, okay, he basically, Mao, I just found this out, so here, I'm sharing it with you. A lot of thousand flowers bloom came from, they had like a few week time when Mao said, everyone who disagrees with me, you know, let a thousand flowers, everyone speak up, and then he murdered them all. Like, genius. All right, this stuff, these flowcharts and things, I just don't think that the ability to program is correlated or anti-correlated with some of the other skill sets necessary to make games, right? So I think the cross-disciplinary people are awesome and worth more than 2x their weight. But it's not, you can have the most awesome artist and the most awesome programmer, and they don't have to be able to do each other's jobs. And being able to program doesn't necessarily mean it's a better artist or not, and I think that's actually true potentially about AI as well. And I'm not sure, and this is where it gets really hand-wavy. But I want to be clear, this is code. Like, it is not, just because I drew it in pixels does not mean it's not code. So in these things, these things I would claim that just crush their problem. Like, they just, like, I mean, it's not that they, we're not innovating on them. It's not like, hey, let me add another texture onto my texture map and some tangent frames and some, like, normal maps. Like, obviously, like, hey, you're going to continue, like, pushing things forward. But, like, the texture map triangle basically is just, like, just fit. You know, it just did 3D virtual reality. Like, meshes, wavetable synthesis. Where does the code live in all these? It doesn't live in the degrees of freedom. Right? They're all data. The code, and there's tons of code for dealing with triangles in a modern engine. It just isn't in the triangles themselves. It's not little scriptlets for dealing with them. It's operating on the structure. It pulls back and deals with it through the interface of the structure. It doesn't live in the degrees of freedom. And I think that's important for getting people of other disciplines to be able to contribute. I would make the argument, given infinite time, that code actually, in some interesting ways, does not actually meet any of these five characteristics, but I'm going to just focus on two that I don't have to really argue too much about. Code is not intuitive. You cannot look at a piece of code and know what it does without thinking really hard and pretending you're a CPU and simply going, okay, this goes over there and that goes over there. You can't just, like, it's not a, you can't just judge it, right? You can't glance. I mean, anybody who's had to debug somebody else's code, I mean, just curly brace style will throw you off, right? Like, it's just, it's very complicated. That's why we get paid so much money. It's not blendable. There are some crazy people, like, who write programs like 3Lisp and stuff that try, like, Lisp is bait for this. Like, they try and reason about what's going on in the actual code with other code, but you just quickly run into this kind of, like, Gödelian, like, halting problem kind of thing. Like, you can't figure out what code's doing from other code, right? You can hardly figure it out in your own head, let alone writing code to figure it out. And so that blendability, it doesn't have that characteristic. Tick AI is not a good degree of freedom. It's totally opaque. It's the code equivalent of a neural net, right? It's like, from the standpoint of the person calling Tick AI, I have no idea what's on the other side of that function call. Like, I can't get in there like I can with a texture map and go make it tint it red if I want to tint it red. I've got no ability to reason about what goes on in there. And that's a huge problem. I think that's at the crux of the problem. So here is my prediction. Okay, ready for this? There will be a structural versus style decomposition for AI. Okay? And the style will not be based on code. So what does that mean? Well, slightly controversially, it means there will eventually be a Photoshop of AI, I claim. I have no fucking idea what this is going to look like, but it's like, you're in a room and you're blind and you can feel like the walls and you can't feel a wall in that way and you're like, where's the wall there? And there's something missing there in that direction. And I think it will actually be this because the structure versus style decomposition has been so immensely powerful at solving all these other pretty varied problems. Like, there are problems that in the set that I've talked about that are output-only leaf problems. There are problems that are, like, right in the middle of the game engine. There are problems in all different parts of the thing. AI is harder. I mean, that's probably why we haven't figured this out yet. But I think this will happen. And so how to actually make this into anything useful, because I don't know how to do this. In the near term, I think what you want to do is look for the structure versus style decomposition for your game's AI. So, AI in general is a really hard problem. Your game's AI might not be that hard of a problem because it's so specific. For the exact same reasons it's easier to write a renderer for one game than it is to write a rendering engine that can do multiple games, figuring out the structure versus style decomposition for your game's AI might be possible. It still is probably going to be hard work because it's just, like, a different way of thinking about the thing. But the upside is if you can do that, if you can cobble together the Photoshop of AI for your game, like these texture maps on the bottom illustrate, you'll be able to come up with this immense like expressionary breadth if you can do that. And I kind of think that's the holy grail. Like, I think that's kind of part of what's missing. Like, there will be code. The code determines how the degrees of freedom are reasoned about. There's going to be a ton of code. But the actual stylistic operations of the AI, I think, will eventually be data. And that is my talk. Thank you. Oh, I'm supposed to remind you to fill out your forms and don't turn your cell phone on during my talk and something else. Are there any questions? I think there's mics, so if anyone has a question. Yes, no? Yes, someone's running for the thing.
Hi, Chris. I don't really have a question on what you said because I have to think hard about it.
I would have to say something concrete for you to have a question about it.
All right, so have you read Jeff Hawkins' book on intelligence?
No, is it Jeff Orkin's book?
Jeff Hawkins.
Oh, no, I haven't.
Maybe you should because some of the stuff you said.
Excellent. That wasn't a question, but mine wasn't a lecture either, so touche. Is there another question?
Well, it's probably a comment, not a question, too, but what the heck, there's nobody behind me. My name's Chuck Rich. I'm an AI researcher. I've been for 30 years.
Okay.
I guess I was a little bothered. It seems to me that in your discussion about code, you're falling into a very old sort of kind of conundrum that was hashed around in the 80s in AI and kind of left by the wayside as not being productive, which is sort of the difference between procedural and declarative representations, which
sure.
I'm sure you've heard all of that.
Sure.
And the problem with the notion of code, the way you put it out, is anything that's structure is code. So, for example, when you say code, you're thinking of, you know, C code or this code or that code, but actually your mesh structure is code for the renderer as an interpreter. And so I think there's something...
I'm not sure. So I would actually disagree with that in the sense that, like, I can see where... I mean, you can kind of philosophically, like, approach these things from, like, code is data, data is code. Like, you know, this list is basically,
exactly.
Like, you know, like, 50 years ago, like, yes, hey, look, they're both the same. But from a standpoint of, like, the structure that I'm talking about is, like, the specification of what you're going to talk about. Right, like of how you're going to talk about something, and then the what that you talk about being the stylistic data thing. The code is not the structure or the style. The code like lives on this side of the structure and like talks to the style through the structure in some sense. It's like the API in some sense. So I think that like, I mean, you can trivially like you can write the code to like generate a bitmap, and you can then show someone Photoshop. And there's just it's not like I mean it's academically interesting, but it didn't even start as a competition, right? It's like someone can go into Photoshop and do something, and writing a you know reaction diffusion texture generator is really hard and hard to tune, right? And it's like that there's something there, there's something inherently there that is really important, and I think that oftentimes we can get lost in the like. I'm gonna make an analogy that's completely random. Oftentimes, computer scientists ignore the constant in big O notation, right? Yeah, it's O n. I'm done. But like, no, you're not, because the constant in the real world matters, and sometimes it matters more than n. And so, like, in this sense, like, you can make an argument that like code and data are the same, but in the constant in front of the big O is giant for data, right? For more traditional forms of data, I guess is what I'm saying.
I'll take the rest of my answer offline.
Next, anyone? Yes, yeah, so feel free to send me an email, of course. Yeah.
You referred to skeletal animation as a good decomposition, but AI isn't. Both of them are blendable in the sense that you're creating these same sorts of state trees, and in one you're blending animations through this logical tree, and in the other, you're blending behavior.
Well, no, because there's I should have mentioned this. There's a really big difference between ability to blend inputs and outputs of a black box system and ability to blend what's inside there. So in AI, I can clearly, like, I mean, the Sim stuff does this, like a whole bunch of these different methods that I've done, like, do this. They blend on the once you come back out to a state vector, you can add and subtract those things, but what actually happens inside there, which is where the actual like mojo lives, like what actually it feels like to play, that's opaque, right? Whereas in an animation, I can actually go in there to frame 32 and take the quaternion out and make it rotate by 90 degrees, and the animation will do this, right? Like, I can reason about the actual thing inside. So yeah, the inputs and outputs, we've done an okay job. I mean, it's a computer, so you have to actually make that into like a state vector at some point if you want to actually write it to disk. But like, the code makes it too opaque, kind of like a neural network. Like, it's just, you don't know what that node does. Like, it's just totally, yeah, so.
And the other unrelated question is, when you say that the triangle has won, with all the problems we're having with destructible environments these days, is it that we've just gotten to a local solution that was good enough for the technology at the time?
I mean, there's an infinite amount of money for you if you can come up with something better than the triangle. So, like, I mean, it's just, the triangle has just crushed everybody, right? Everybody constantly is coming up with, like, oh, this will work out great. Oh, no, triangle, z-buffer triangle. You know, like, it's just got so many nice things about it. So it's not that I think it's the best in some bizarre world where, you know, I mean, it's just practically speaking, it is just miles ahead of everybody else. Like, it's just got so many of these things that I'm talking about, and probably more that I'm missing. Linearity, like all of these things, so, yeah.
Thanks.
Yep.
Hi there. I was trying to apply your kind of model here to the game that I want to see one day. What I think is going to be the Citizen Kane of computer games is the romantic comedy game.
That would be great.
It's the simplest kind of movie to make. It's the cheapest one to make, and it's the one that's most difficult for games to ever do.
I have a web page that says exactly that thing on my website, yes.
So, looking at this, the structure is boy meets girl, boy loses girl, rediscovers her, everyone lives happily ever after. Structure's fine.
No, that's Hollywood script structure. That's a very different kind of structure.
It's a kind of structure.
You can't reason about that with a computer, though.
We're working on that. So, a style, there are many different ways to present romantic comedy, like wacky female main character or brooding, destructive guy discovers life through a girl's experience, whatever. So, looking at your 5 points here, intuitive, everyone gets romantic comedies. Expressive, many different ways of telling the same story. Frugal, does seem to be a minimal storyline that it absolutely cannot be changed, the basic structure. Blendable, kind of, yeah, okay. And efficient, what?
This is the problem with not having math in your cock. It's because, like, I've got nothing. The kind of thing I'm talking about when I talk about structure versus style is I try to define it really rigorously on, I mean, really rigorously is like a kind of a joke, but like, whee! Like, this page, like, I need something, the structure has to tell me a floating point number that I can go modify and what that means. Like, in a triangle, I know Z, if I have a world coordinate system where Z is up, the Z entry in the triangle is how high it is off the ground. Like, that's an incredibly awesome piece of semantic information associated with this floating point number, right? I can now write a piece of code that loops over all my triangles and make sure all of them are above Z equals 1 meter, right? That is something I can, like, reason about. I can, like, it's concrete, it's like, it's actionable, right? I have no idea how to say boy meets girl, like what that means. I think Hollywood structure-wise, that means a lot. Like, I mean, Dave, what's his name's, structure stuff. Like, you know, they use the word structure all the time in Hollywood for, like, what it means and, like, the three-act structure and the nine-act structure and all that. But that's not structure in that I have a way more rigorous, well, it's a pathetic definition. I have a way more rigorous idea that I can't, I'm probably unable to communicate about what structure needs to mean. I need to be able to, like, write a three-line piece of C code that does something through a piece of to this, given the structure as its like definition of what it's operating on, and I would love it more than anything to figure out how to do a romantic comedy. But like, it's miles different kind of structure. I think is the problem.
Thanks.
Sorry. Fill out your review forms.
It seems like a common thread among the things that you say have this kind of decomposition or a pattern of the things that you say have this kind of decomposition is that there's a formalization. We know when we talk about bones, when we talk about polygons, when we talk about waveforms,
totally.
We know exactly what we're talking
Form
about.
Form versus content is kind of a way of saying what I'm saying. I think it's a little less precise, but yeah.
So for AI, we don't have a formalization. We don't have a specification or something like that. So
right.
Is it a matter of someone coming up with being brave enough or lucky enough to come up with a formalization that everyone sort of agrees on, or and if so, I'm not sure where I was going with that. But yeah, if
I think I see what you're saying. I hesitate here. Let me caveat what I'm about to say, because I don't actually think this means that you should have. I mean, I don't think specifying AI right now, we're ready for that. I just don't. I think that endeavors in that direction are less than totally useful. just like I don't think AI middleware actually works very well right now. It's not the time for that, because we haven't actually. You get OpenGL and D3D once you've got the triangle. You end up with figs if you try and do it before you've got the triangle, right? If that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And like, so you need to figure it out. We need to figure it out in the small, and then, oh, that actually did work this way. Like, you don't write the game engine before you've written the game, right?
So is it a cause and effect relationship? You come up with a specification and you result in this decomposition?
No,
I
think it's iterative. I think you are trying a bunch of different things bottom up. That's the way I tend to do things. But like, I mean, if you have an idea of what it is for AI, like, for God's sakes, write it down. But like, it needs to be testable, right? You need to be able to go implement a cool AI with it and like get people to like paint AI, whatever the fuck that means, right? But I don't think we're going to come to this. Just like triangles didn't, no one came down. You know, Ivan Sutherland didn't like come down from on high and go like the triangle will be what it is. Like, you know, it's like it was just like they were battling it out. Like people tried NURBS, and NURBS are really cool if you want to just make a NURB, but you can't like stitch them together. And oh, how do you, you know? And it just got crazy. And then people were just like, look, this really stupid, simple brute force thing can do that, and it can do that, it can do that. And yeah, you need a lot of them to make a NURB, to make something like a NURB surface out of it. But guess what? We can do a lot of them because they're really simple. And like it's. It just starts to win bottom up, basically. So if you have an idea top down, great, because you can just skip all that crap in between, which is the making mistakes part. But like, the world rarely works that way, right? So that's why I think that like, you know, writing white papers and stuff about like how AI should be in games, or trying to like, now is not the time to start an AI middleware company, or something like that. I guess. So apologies to people starting middleware companies right now.
Thank you.
Yes.
Hi. Yeah. I don't know if maybe I'm missing the point, or if a lot of what you said went over my head, but when listening to your lecture, it reminded me a lot of Ken Perlin's work, and I was wondering if you were aware of it and like what your opinion of it is.
Yeah, I mean, Ken actually is trying to. Is Ken in the room? He's probably. Oh, he doesn't get here tomorrow. So he's got a thing tomorrow. He's got a poster session tomorrow, and a roundtable he's doing on Friday. And I'm not sure what I'd call what he's doing AI, but he does try for a more structured style decomposition. He does that by making it more like animation than AI. He's just kind of got this emergent thing, and like, you know, he does it by snipping together a lot of code, but I think you could probably data drive it or, you know, make it a stylistic thing. In fact, one of the problems I have with Ken's stuff that I talked to about with him is that his stuff all looks the same. It's all this kind of bouncy kind of thing, and part of that's because that's the code he wrote, and he doesn't have any way of like making it act different. And so he's going to talk about that actually tomorrow, I think. And one of his research projects this year is to try and figure out how to parameterize it that way. So yeah, I think that he's doing it lower level than what I would call. I mean, AI is a totally general term in the game industry, right? Like, I mean, I think there's AI on the mouse, you know, input when you've got like extrapolation and stuff going on. His stuff is, I'd be fine calling it AI, but it's certainly low level, like animation oriented, like, you know, that kind of like. Oh, let me put a look at on over to that object and stuff like that. So yeah, I mean, but I don't think he's not. I don't think he's consciously thinking in these terms yet. We'll see. I don't know.
Question. It's what came to mind with a lot of what you were talking about here. Isn't there an example of this kind of thing that seems to me to have both structure and style in terms of AI or artificial personality or something or other, based around something that's been around for 30 years at least, and that's the one of the kind of fundamental things underlying most RPGs, which is stats. And if you tie, that is things like strength, intelligence,
yeah, I mean, in some sense,
like, things like that,
right.
You have a structure, and if you tie that to behavior, which is not hard to do,
right.
At least didn't seem hard to do, and then give you a data you say define, okay, it can be a value between this and this.
I mean, essentially, you're saying basically Excel is the Photoshop of tuning, which I think is true, actually. I mean, like, if you went to Pardo's talk today, he, like, shows the spreadsheet of, like, hey, it's the armor class, and I think that's true. Excel, I mean, I think people write tuning tools that give you a slightly better view on it than Excel, but I think that's true, and that's actually a really good point, which I should have actually thought of myself. Thank you. Which is, like, yeah, I mean, to the extent that once you've got everything defined in your game and you're just tuning, you've got this giant set of parameters. If those parameters are really good and really intuitive, if those degrees of freedom that you've exposed are good, maybe that does start to get to like a hint of what it might look like. Except for those do behavior in the same way that fuzzy if-then rules do. Like, it's like, oh, let me raise the armor class a little bit, which will emergently like make this if statement go a different direction, which then this guy acts this way. I hope it goes deeper than that, I guess. If it just stops at tuning, like, then I don't think we've gotten. So I'm hoping like something here goes deeper than just the like parameter-based tuning. And so maybe that might be an entryway. That's a really good point. Like, I'll put that on the website when I put these slides up. Like, the because that is kind of what I'm talking about, writ small in some sense. Yeah, totally. And it does affect AI. That's, I guess, in the kind of hierarchy of like, there's data driving. Traditional old hot-loaded data driving thing here, and there's like the texture map triangle. Like, that's closer to this side still. Like, you're still like, it's just parameters and stuff. But like, it's starting to, like, it does affect behavior for the same reasons you were just saying. So, yeah, I don't know. I'll think about it more.
Well, we certainly did a long time ago. A game around that.
Yeah. Like,
everything was done that way.
Right.
I mean, whether somebody attacked or talked or helped or
right.
hindered or whatever,
right.
just based on those kinds of a set of parameters, and you could different characters with intuitive personalities based on the kinds of stuff that you could say, well, gee, what if you make this guy extremely aggressive, daring,
sure.
whatever, and then he will tend to rush into things that
right.
somebody else who's
right.
much more cautious or less aggressive or something will not.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have people,
right.
a group of AIs walk into a room and have one person, one AI, one character, go charge. Oh, they're zombies or something, and go charge forward and attack. And have somebody else with a different personality look at the same scenario
sure.
and turn around and go running out of the room.
Yeah,
and we did
totally. No, it's a good example. I think I hope that it goes much farther than that. Like, I hope it gets up into the similar level of expressibility. Like, I can reskin and repaint a level and have it just completely change its, like, it gets at a deeper level with the texture map triangle is more evolved than that, and hopefully it'll go. But I think it's a really good example. So thanks.
Isn't there like isn't this kind of the meta problem? I mean, AI is kind of code, and we're writing code, and you kind of said you want to have three lines of code that you can use to write the code. It just feels to me like, what you're describing as the Photoshop of AI is Emacs, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, but except for code, like, text code doesn't satisfy a lot of these things. Like,
no, it doesn't. I mean,
yeah.
but from the point of view of, I think you're trying to get at how do we express logic in ways that don't require so much logic?
I mean, in some sense, yes. I'm trying to say, like, does behavior require code, right? So, and I used to think, yes, of course it does, but it's not clear to me now. Like, there's such a gap in the, like, advancement. There's such a gap in the expressibility that you get from making a Photoshop of something, whether it's SoundForge or Photoshop or Maya or whatever, like, that maybe it's wishful thinking. I mean, the whole thing would be a crock, for all I know. But, like, I just see these problems that just sit solved in such an amazing way, and they don't necessarily seem like... So, yeah, does behavior require code? That's why I put it on the slide. I don't know the answer. I used to think yes, and now I'm not so sure. I guess that's the crux.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. Question thinking about DNA, which is blendable, it's expressible, it's expressive, it's efficient, all that. But as things get very complex, it's not intuitive.
Right, well, because it's code. I mean, DNA is code, right? Like, it's like, I mean, you've got genetic programming where if you make your thing out of Lisp, you can, like, add things together and you get something and hopefully it works.
But again, I mean, I think the guy who talked about the surface, it's instructions on how to build a render, ultimately. So, I just question about the intuitive thing as things get really complex.
Right.
Rather, you can expect to have an intuitive representation.
Yeah, and I think that that's part of the choice of degree of freedom. Like, it's not. I would claim that genetic programming or Lisp or DNA, any kind of encoding in assembly code, like people, some people optimize by like restructuring their assembly. Like, I would claim that's just another way of viewing code, like a flowchart. That's not actually making the degree of freedom, like the stylistic degree of freedom switch that needs to happen. So, but I don't know. Yeah, we'll see. I think we're out of time. So, thank you.